The long beleaguered Kansas City Public School District made a big announcement this morning. Its students scored an 82.9 on the latest round of state assessment tests. This was way more points than anyone expected and a sign that the district is well on its way to fully regaining full accreditation after 3 decades without it. Considering that a score of 70 is needed for the state to even consider full accreditation, the 82.9 is a big, big deal. And here to talk about it and what it means is Superintendent Mark Bedell. Mark, welcome back. Congratulations.
Thanks, Steve. It's a great feeling to be here as usual.
I bet. It's a big day in the district, and I just want to point out, I wrote a column that appeared in the newspaper this morning talking about what a big moment this is for the district. So how big of a deal is this, Mark? How would you describe it?
It's big. It's important that our constituents feel that the district is in good hands, right, with the board of directors that they've elected, in addition to the superintendent and the administrative team working to support our building principals and our teachers. Mm-hmm. And making sure that we're doing our full due diligence of being responsible with taxpayers' money to get a return on whatever it is we invest in terms of student academic outcomes. And so we're very excited right now.
You know, I've got to ask you, how surprised were you when your assistant superintendents called you and over the phone one day you told me with the news that you had scored an 82.9?
I was surprised because I knew we were going to score over a 70. I mean, I felt real good about the academic systems we put in place, the framework that we have in place, the strategic plan, and then even the investment. So I knew we were going to be over 70. I honestly just didn't think it would be at an 82.9.
You were hoping for a 75.
Well, yeah, that's what I thought. I was thinking 75, 76. So to get an 82.9 was good. And then to figure out and realize that we actually got the 82.9 without the use of Hold Harmless, which, you know, we could talk about in a little bit, that makes it even more assuring around sustainability.
This Hold Harmless thing is significant because, as you said, your district achieved it without using that. And it's basically, if I understand it right, it's where a district can use past scores from previous years to sort of patch over shortcomings in new test scores that might be a little subpar. It's sort of like you're going to the bank to achieve a new score here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's fair. I mean, in a lot of different states, they handle the changes to an assessment differently. Some years it's just a baseline year. And in essence, this data that we have with our MAP assessments is baseline. But there has to be some type of protection when you continuously are changing assessments. You can't continuously penalize schools every time there's a change in assessment. I don't think it's fair to the work of the teachers and most certainly fair to those students that are out here every year having to continuously pivot to new mm-hmm. assessments. And so I told people at the press conference this morning, let me be very clear. If we needed it, we would use it just like anybody else. But it does feel good that we didn't have to use it.
Yeah. So the word from state officials seems to be, and has been for a while, that you have to achieve 70-plus scores over 70 points for 2 years in a row to regain full accreditation. First, when was the last time this district had full accreditation?
I don't know.
I've asked
a lot of people. I've had people who've worked in this school district for 23, 24 years that were there saying the fact that we're having these conversations, that it's a possibility. It once again reassures their commitment to this school system that they've been able to withstand all of this and that they've made a difference. And so the truth is, I don't know. I've asked and I'm trying to figure that out. I hear decades mm-hmm. And I think it's something that this city deserves. Our students deserve it. And that's the most fair and equitable thing that we can do.
You know, there is a sense for just so people who aren't involved with the district should understand that whether you're the superintendent or you're a principal or you're a teacher or a student or a parent inside the Kansas City, Missouri School District, that you attend schools that in a district that hasn't been fully accredited. Right now it's partially accredited. And that sort of puts a little cloud over things at times, doesn't it?
Oh, it absolutely does. I mean, I think everybody knows we live in a country, especially an educational system, where everything is based on your accreditation and are you fully accredited or provisional or unaccredited. I think it makes a difference in the perception that people will have of your school system and your ability to properly educate students. And I often tell people that accreditation is good, and I'm excited about the fact that we are definitely headed in that direction to get it, but it shouldn't be the end game. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the day, for me, it's more that we are preparing kids to compete at or above state average and to compete at a high level on the national assessments. And that's really what I told our people. That's what we're going after. Getting the accreditation gets this gorilla off of your shoulders. Mm-hmm. And it really does allow for you to market your district a little bit differently, especially in a highly competitive educational landscape.
Mm-hmm. So you want to be on the same par as schools in Lee Summit.
That's correct.
That's what you're gaming for here.
That's
the
my
ultimate
end game.
Goal. Yeah.
I mean, I get it. The kids show up differently. You and I, you've had an opportunity to spend some time with me. And I think it opened up your eyes around some of the things that our students were telling you that they have to deal with.
Absolutely.
That in some cases, kids that live in some of the suburban areas just never would have to fathom experiencing. And I try to tell people, despite all of these variables that these kids show up with, you know, we can't use that as a crutch. And I don't want my kids using it as a crutch. Our job is to put the supports in place socially and emotionally so that they can achieve academically and to give them this fixed mindset and this level of self-efficacy that if you just put in the work, mm-hmm. work hard, you can work your way out of any kind of situation. But we got to help you.
Yeah, I remember sitting with you, I think at Melcher Elementary School last winter, and listening to a table full of kids describe what they hear at night and even hear on the way to school in the mornings, the sounds of gunshots. And that certainly is an experience that, you know, for all obvious reasons, rattles those kids. But you don't hear students very often in the Shawnee Mission School District sharing a similar experience.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, and I think every school district is different. Kids have different issues that they're dealing with. I just try to tell people that anytime you look at our school district, I just want you to be fair and utilize context because it is a different situation in terms of some of the things that our kids are dealing with versus students in other school systems. And we have to take those variables into account because they are real. Mobility is real. Evictions are real. You don't have the type of eviction rates that you have here in Kansas City and in these suburban areas. And that's just the reality of it.
And you also have this situation where you have kids moving in and out of your schools at a far higher rate than many other school districts. I think I've seen a number that 4 out of 10 kids, fully 40% of students who begin the school year in the Kansas City, Missouri School District won't end the year in the district.
Yeah, that's correct, Steve. And in some of our schools, it's much higher. We have some schools where that is upwards of 70%. And the truth is, what we said that we wanted to do was to just make sure that if they're transferring within our school system, that we were consistent with following an instructional framework that a kid could easily mesh into in another school, having their data follow them from iReady. So you being able to utilize that universal screener that would allow for us to really know where kids are, where are the gaps. And for us, part of the reason why we got this type of progress is a lot of it is on growth, mm-hmm. moving a ton of kids out of below basic into basic, and then we start to now move them towards proficiency. But it's giving them the ability to access the standards.
So when you have kids moving around that much, what kind of burden does that place on your teaching staff?
Well, it's difficult because in some cases it's just constant restart with kids. And when kids are moving in, and I know the level of frustration, I attended a ton of different elementary schools and I'm frustrated. I'm upset. I have to make new friends. I have to get to know a new teacher. Mm-hmm. I'm in a new neighborhood.
Much less figure out the academics.
Yeah, yeah. And mm-hmm. so what we're trying to do is create a culture and climate in all of our schools where all of our kids feel welcomed. It's conducive to students being able to come in there and learn. But also, I want students to be vulnerable, that they can talk about some of the social and emotional distress, because if we can help control for that, that no longer becomes an impediment to them succeeding academically.
Right. You know, one other factor, I just want to touch on it before I get back to the whole accreditation thing, Mark, but the one other way the state measures the proficiency of the Kansas City, Missouri School District and every other school district in the state is on attendance. And there's a benchmark that says students, you need to have your entire student body in class 90% of the time each day when the school bell rings, or they're counted as absent. And that's been a big challenge in your school district.
Yeah, absolutely. We've earned 6 out of 10 points on attendance. And it is based on students being in school 90% of the time and accessing 90% of the minutes. If a student, let's use a high school student for example, if that high school student gets in and they've missed that first period and they have 7 periods or 8 periods during the day, they've in essence missed 11% or 12% of the day. It's the same as them being absent. Once you fall to 89%, you could come and be in school, but you will get a zero that day for 90-90. That's just the reality of it, and that has been a struggle for us, really working, and that's where we need support from our parents and our community. We need them there every day for ADA, which is average daily attendance, because that's how we get funding. And then we need them there for 90-90 purposes, because that's how we get our accreditation points.
Mark Bedell is my guest. If you want to join our conversation on this day that the district has announced that it scored an 82.9 on the latest round of state assessment tests, we'd like to hear from you. 816-235-2888 is the number. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What does this mean in your mind about the future of the Kansas City, Missouri School District? How are you feeling about the district these days? 816-235-2888. Talk to me about the American history scores that you just received, Mark, and what you found there.
Yeah, so we talk about having the consistency of an assessment from one year to the other. And the only comparable assessment that we have right now is the American government from last year to this year. And so in 2017, our district was at 34.8% in terms of proficiency. I believe the state average is probably somewhere in the upper 60s as a whole. And then we moved from 34.8% to 41.4%, which is significant in terms of moving more students into proficient and advanced. In addition, the Missouri Performance Index is basically how they justify who gets below basic, proficient, and then advanced. So we were at 296.1 last year, and we moved that up to 304.6. Being able to earn status in that, the state says you need to be at 300 to earn status. What I'm extremely proud of is that we talk a lot about how do we close gaps against the state overall average. I don't think the state's going to jump 6.6 percentage points or whatever it is, 6.6 percentage points.
So your point is you're moving faster than your peer districts across the state.
That's what we have to do. We have to close these gaps. And a lot of it, Steve, just rewriting the curriculum, aligning it, getting it vetted by professionals. That piece right there has made a huge difference in now how fast we can move.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's critical.
I want to go back and just finish up the bit about accreditation then. You're hearing from state officials. The Kansas City Star is hearing from Margie Van Deven, the state education commissioner, that she wants to see above 70 scores 2 years in a row. Is that the expectation that you're going into your conversations with Margie? Is it any chance you can get full accreditation in the 3 or 4 months to come?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, my job is to always try to seek it and see if we can get it. But if Margie says, okay, Dr. Bedell, this is what DESE has always had in place.
Department of Elementary and Secondary Education.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, that's correct. If that's what the system says we have to adhere to, I have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. I honestly, if that's not something that we've adhered to in the past, then yeah, I'm going to have some different questions. But I'm very confident. I've been doing these meetings with our principals. We got this. We got the results we received here, and we didn't even have the type of resources that we have right now. I mean, the reading interventionist, math interventionist, have an eye ready.
What is reading and math intervention? What is that?
They come in and they help with our students. We utilize. We put them on the universal screener. We find out that kids are missing critical concepts that won't allow for them to access the state grade level standard. So if you're in the third grade, you should be able to do certain things. We're able to figure out what those gaps are, and then we pull those kids, and we have reading and math interventionists that work with them to fill the gaps.
Individual attention
individual,
to move them along.
Individual, very prescriptive. Mm-hmm. Everything that we've done has been methodical. It's been intentional. It's been prescriptive. And that's how you generate sustainability, where you're not up and down every other year with these assessments.
You know, Mark, some folks listening to this might be hearing you talk and hearing you explain how you're moving things along, and they might be wondering, why has it taken this district so many years to get this kind of instructional method in place, this kind of leadership, because we've been floundering without full accreditation for so long?
Here's what I will say. I think the district challenges have been documented pretty well. And I think that, you know, you can't sit here and say that previous superintendents and administrators were terrible, because I said in the press conference today, Covington's job, I mean,
a previous
he had to close schools,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? And he had, because we would have been in financial distress had that not happened. Stephen Green then came in and he started working on getting the district to its provisional accreditation. A master plan was passed and implemented by interim superintendent Al Tunis. There were just certain things that needed to take place in order for us to get in this space. And so I like to say that I really do get instruction. I was a teacher. I worked my way all the way through. And this is something that we're good at doing with the team that I have. So we've been able to come in and just really focus on mm-hmm. teaching and learning and giving our teachers a fair chance to be successful and letting them know that they are making a difference. Even if they don't see the proficiency rates, it's hard to move a kid from below basic to basic.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've done that, you've given the next teacher a better opportunity to move these kids to proficient and beyond.
You know, tell me about this morning when you announced to your staff and teachers and principals that the district had achieved this score this last year. What was the reaction?
Well, I try to be tough. I mean, you know, I come from a very tough background, and just seeing everybody with the standing ovations, it gave me this sense that this is something that people have been wanting for a long time. And there are a lot of people who never gave up on this school system. I think it was a lot of frustration over the decades. But many of these people have been waiting on this day, right? People believe that a traditional public school system can work, that neighborhood schools can work. And they should work regardless of your socioeconomic status or your race or your zip code. And we think that if we can standardize some things, but still allow for our principals to have the autonomy to utilize their style and allow for our teachers to utilize their style, but say this is the curriculum and these are the things that the state of Missouri expects our kids to be able to know and do, adhere to that, then we think that that's a formula for success.
Talk to me about the emotion in the room.
Oh, man, it was tough. Listen, it was... My heart was touched, and for me, I came here
hard
and I said to Mark everybody, Bedell.
Hard bitten Mark Bedell was even touched by the emotion in that room.
I was touched, man, because I firmly believe that these kids deserve more than what we are giving them right now. I do. I think if you've never had a relationship with these students, if you haven't sat down and talked to these students, you know, everybody paints this negative picture of these kids. These kids want to have a fair chance to better their lives, right? And it's our job to figure out where that gift is and to tap into it, but then to have high expectations. These kids deserve so much more.
So
I think what's really got me to be pretty emotional earlier with everybody standing up, because it isn't about Dr. Bedell or the board or the administration. It really is about those teachers and what they're doing to work directly with those kids. And I know how hard that is, because I was a teacher, and it's hard.
So when you announced this, I gather there were, as you mentioned, the standing ovation, there were tears, hug, I guess the whole gamut of stuff, right?
There was. And there was validation that this work that we're doing, as hard as it is, that it is actually paying dividends.
Right.
Like people are starting to believe, like, we're not just doing this stuff just to make you do these things. I told our principals, when we ask you to take these assessments, you know, we're not asking, we're not trying to expose you or embarrass you or anything like that, but you need to have an idea of how you could best support your teachers and how they can best support our students.
Because you actually have your superintendents take the assessment test, so mm-hmm. they have a direct understanding of what tests the students are taking to these numbers that are so important to your district.
Well, it is. And I think I want the audience in here to clearly understand that it isn't about teaching to a test. It is about understanding what the state requires of our students, and that we are making sure that our curriculum makes sense. And that if we teach the concepts and the objectives the way that they are supposed to be taught, then ultimately task will predict performance. And that's a big part of our instructional framework. We just want to make sure that our kids are graduating with a thorough understanding of what the state of Missouri expect kids to learn, mm-hmm. just like any other state. I remember working in Texas, and the governor back then said Texans will determine what Texans learn. And at the end of the day, you have to take Texas history. You have to know the things about the state that you're graduating from, because each state believes that their curriculum is what will allow for you to thrive across all of the other states in this country and globally.
You know, one other issue before you go that this district has faced for so many years is this revolving door of superintendents. Every year or two or three, someone's out the door. You took the job in January of 2016. You're just launching into your fourth year as a result, and your contract is up. You're about to begin negotiations. What is Mark Bedell thinking today about the prospect of sticking around a little longer?
It's highly likely. I mean, I've been very clear with everybody. What I don't want to do is be in a situation where we get people excited, people start to believe, and then all of a sudden we have to have a restart. I don't think that's fair to these students and to this community. There have definitely been opportunities to look into other school districts, much larger. And I've constantly said to people that my work isn't finished here. And I'm committed. I really am. So we are getting ready to enter into contract negotiations. We'll close out my evaluation, which was an 18-month process or so. We were just waiting to get the data back. So we'll close out the evaluation on February 9th, and then we will start to negotiate and try to get another 3-year contract sealed.
That's Mark Bedell. He's the superintendent of the Kansas City, Missouri School District. They just announced today an 82.9 score on the latest round of state assessment tests. You need a 70 to get full accreditation. The hope now is that full accreditation comes perhaps early in 2020, right? That'd be the hope.
Well, if we get our data back sooner, we'd hope we'd get it at the end of this year.
Okay.
That's what I would hope. We should get our data back a lot earlier than we did this year.
If the state moves a little bit quicker. Okay. That's Mark Bedell. Congratulations. Thanks for the time, Mark.
Thank
sure
you,
appreciate
Steve.
It.
Appreciate you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about an historic barn in Lawrence that once served as a station on the Underground Railroad. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, the CanCare backlog of applications had us asking just how bad the state's Medicaid program is. You can hear that and other conversations. You'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. Monday learned about the 1946 arrest of a black soldier that sparked the racial awakening of President Harry Truman and ignited the first presidential commission on civil rights. That conversation Monday on KCUR. KCUR's up to date. Well, Grover's Barn in Lawrence has served as a sculptor's studio and as a fire station. These days, though, the city uses it as a storage site, but shortly after it was built in 1858, it became a stop on the Underground Railroad that helped freedom seekers making their way to points as far north as Canada. Now, a conversation about one of the most famous of these trips, one comprised of 12 freedom seekers and led by a committed abolitionist. His name was John Brown. With us today from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence, Judy Sweets is a historical researcher and genealogist. Judy, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Carrie Altenburnd is a historian and historical reenactor. Carrie, nice to have you too. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, Judy, how did you first come to find out that this old barn had this historic connection to the Underground Railroad?
I believe I was reading a manuscript by Craig Crosswhite when I was working at Watkins Museum in Lawrence, and his manuscript mentioned that the Underground Railroad came through there. So that piqued my interest.
And what did you do with that interest?
Well, and then I had some friends who were working on a painting that Tully and Wayne Wildcat. Wayne Wildcat is an artist, and he wanted to find out more information about the Underground Railroad and paint a large painting. So that made me look at more sources at the museum.
Carrie, how did you learn then that John Brown, the famous abolitionist so prominently depicted in the Kansas State House, his visage has always scared kids, I think, who go over there on field trips, that he once brought runaway slaves to the barn back in 1859?
Well, I had met Judy and Wayne back in the 90s and knew somewhat of the story, but it was pretty much a slow progression. I got involved with saving the Blackjack Battlefield in Douglas County mm-hmm. back in the early 2000s. And then I got more interested in John Brown, decided I should start telling his story because the story that people knew wasn't the story that I found out was the truth.
I was going to say, tell us about that a little bit because you know John Brown pretty well because you have played the role of John Brown in plays and reenactments. Remind us who he was and what you're talking about there, that he wasn't the person a lot of people think he is.
Well, he was an abolitionist. He was committed. He believed literally that everyone was a brother and a sister under God, and that he saw that millions of his black brothers and sisters were in bondage for no reason than the color of their skin. And he worked against that to end slavery his whole life. He came to Kansas in 1855, and the violence out here, the Bleeding Kansas violence, was such that it radicalized him even more to not just work against slavery, but to literally fight against slavery. He was involved in what's known as the Pottawatomie Massacre, which is five pro-slavery men were killed in the middle of the night with broadswords, and that made people think he was a homicidal maniac only after blood, which is totally opposite of what it was. He was driven to that for self-protection and protecting his families, but we won't go into that story now. But the more I knew about John Brown, the more I wanted people to know that he wasn't that. He was a kind, gentle man that was fighting a horrible, the sum of all villainies is what he called it.
Not the wild-eyed crazy man depicted in the State House then.
You read about what people that visited him talked about him and how he was gentle and kind and took care of things. He was kind to animals. But he was stern at the same time. I mean, he was a Calvinist, so he had his own ways. But that needs to be brought out. And I don't say believe what I say, but at least listen to what the story is, and then make your own mind up. But don't just take what's been told to you. And when I found out about John Brown at the barn, that the barn became even more important to me.
Yeah, Judy Sweets, tell us a little bit about the early history of this barn. Where is it in Lawrence? You know, who built it, and who were Joel and Emily Grover, the name that's attached to the barn?
Okay, well, the barn was built in 1858. It's a two-story stone barn, and it is about 3 miles southwest of Lawrence. Of course, at that time, it was during the territorial period, and people were preempting 160 acres of their land, and that's what Joel Grover did. Joel and
Emily.
It
was a really sturdy, beautiful barn, too, in a lot of ways, right?
It really is. It's very well preserved, and it's unique, and right now we feel that it's, you know, very historically significant nationally, not only nationally, but locally. They were a young couple. She was 7 months pregnant, Emily was, and then they accepted, which was against the law. I mean, they were going against the federal law to take in these 12 freedom seekers.
How much do we know about the Grovers and how they came to be involved with the Underground Railroad, Judy?
Well, we know that Joel was an abolitionist, and he came from New York. He had very decided opinions and about slavery, and then after he married Emily in 1857, she also was from an abolitionist-type family back in the East. So once they got here, they met other abolitionists, and, you know, I think they, even though the Underground Railroad was a secret undertaking, I'm sure he was involved with other abolitionists.
Kerry, remind us also what exactly the Underground Railroad was, because, of course, it wasn't an actual railroad.
No, a lot of people, I know some people think it was, it had, you know, engines and smoke. No,
yes, right.
It was, John Brown liked to call it the subterranean passway, but it was a network, a loose network of people who assisted escaped slaves from where they escaped in the South up either into northern states or all the way up into Canada. And as Judy said, it was illegal. From 1850 on, it was against federal law to assist any slave in any way escape. Hmm. Even giving them water could land you in federal penitentiary at hard labor for up to a year and $1,000 fine, $1,000 of 1850s dollars.
Yes,
and that's a huge amount of money. And that's that's what the people on the Underground Railroad, the station masters and the Grovers, risked. But willingly did it because they understood how evil slavery was, and to help one person escape was great, but to help multiple people like the Grovers did to escape was
taking a big risk.
Taking a huge risk. It's really hard to even fathom how much of a risk they were taking.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about a historic barn over just south of Lawrence called Grover's Barn that was a key stop on the Underground Railroad, and the night that John Brown himself brought a dozen slaves to that barn and what happened. You know, Judy, you guys became aware, a key element of this story, became aware of this diary which shed so much light on John Brown's visit to Lawrence on that January night in 1859. How did you come across the diary?
excuse me. Kerry actually told me about the diary, and he shared a transcription with me, and I was just amazed that it gave us so much new information that we didn't know before about John Brown, and also about, it did also mention the 12 freedom seekers who were there at the barn. This was just all new information to historians. And
whose diary was it?
The name was Samuel P. Reed.
And Kerry, who was Samuel Reed, and how did you find the diary?
Well, that's interesting. For a number of years, I was the Douglas County Law Librarian here in Douglas County, and I wrote a newsletter, a monthly newsletter, and had an article in it each month on legal history, but the history of what happened, you know, legal matters, not just court matters, but whatever I thought was a legal matter. And I wrote a number of years ago on this incident, because them bringing the slaves into Douglas County and for freedom was illegal. And a couple of years later, I got an email from someone who had read that. I posted it on the internet, saying that his wife was a direct descendant of this Samuel Reed, and that they had his diary and letters, and that they had transcribed it, and they sent it to me to show me that what I had said was a little incorrect. And so I was overjoyed by that, and of course I let Judy know about it, and so the rest is pretty much, you know, history about how it's come out. This is perhaps the most well-documented Underground Railroad incident in the country, because you did not keep records, because it was illegal.
Because if the records were found, that could implicate how you were helping slaves. Yeah.
Yes, and so by having Samuel Reed keep these documents, and they were kept, and now we've found them, makes it perhaps the most well-documented Underground Railroad incident ever in the United States. That makes it just wonderful.
Let's go to that then. Again, what the diary says about this stop of John Brown's in January of 1859, a dozen slaves in tow. I'm sure it was cold. What does the diary tell us about that night?
Well, the diary... First of all, I just wanted to say that what is new information is that John Brown actually arrived at the barn on the 14th of January, 1859, and we always thought that he was hiding out down in near Osawatomie and was going to bring the slaves up about on the 20th or 20, leave for the, on the 20th. So what we learned was that John Brown arrived at the barn on the 14th, it said he happened in, and this is what Samuel Reed said. And then we learn that Montgomery was also there at the same time. So they were both there on the 14th and the 15th of January. The slaves weren't brought up till, we think, the 24th, and then they left on the 25th. And maybe Kerry would want to tell a little bit about how he talked about that in the diary.
Yeah, please, Kerry.
Well, I'm trying to remember. He said he alluded to them. He didn't say, you know, they're bringing slaves in here. He talked about the them coming in, and when they left, they were going off towards the north. John Brown was taking the 12 off towards the North Star or something like that, implying what was going on
to Canada, right?
To Canada, yes, right. And that is he escorted them all the way to Canada. He didn't cross. He went to Detroit, and they crossed over to Winnipeg and freedom.
Hmm. And the exciting thing is we know all of their names, which is very unusual.
And those the family members have actually been contacted, the present-day family members, right?
Some.
Yes, in 2013, I was able to trace a great-great-grandson of one of the people on the trip, and get in touch with them. And the wife was a genealogist, so that was very helpful.
You know, maybe just given the weather we've been through, I can't help but sort of reflect on this idea that, you know, these slaves and John Brown were traveling in January of the year, and how cold. I assume they traveled at night in the darkness and always wanting to be quiet, and how treacherous these journeys must have been.
Yes.
Perilous, I guess, yeah.
Because there were people out looking for them. I mean,
sure.
They raided in the Vernon County, Missouri, and freed 11. Eventually, one of the women gave birth to a baby on the trip up here that she named John Brown Daniels, after John Brown. But they had to keep hidden because there were slave catchers out trying to catch them, because there were rewards out for them. So, yes, it was extremely perilous. You can't really imagine now how dangerous it was for everybody.
I also was struck here, Kerry, that the slaves, I think I read, they came from Missouri, and that John Brown had liberated them. I mean, what do we know about that? Meaning that he went onto a farm or two and snuck the slaves away?
Well, actually, he was approached in Kansas by a man named Jim Daniels, who was a slave and who was in Kansas supposedly selling brooms. He was a broom maker. His master was allowing him to do that. And actually, his master had died, and his estate was about to be broken up, and all of his family, Jim Daniels' family, sold away down south and asked John Brown for help. John Brown said he would, brought his men into Vernon County, Missouri on December 20th, raided three farmsteads there, eventually liberating 11 slaves and bringing them into Kansas, and then up through Lawrence, Nebraska, across Iowa, and eventually to Detroit.
Again, you almost can't begin to imagine the emotions here, the terror, the concern. Does the diary get into any of those kinds of things?
No, he's kind of suspicious. I mean, he tries to say that, I know I probably shouldn't be saying this, but since John Brown has mentioned this, I'll just say that I have seen the 12. And then he puts 12 little dashes, and he says, I wonder what these mean. And, so he's kind of being a little bit coy about it. And then later he adds another. He says, I guess I might as well add another 14. And he puts 14 more dashes. And we believe that that refers to the John Doy trip that took place the next day. John Doy also left with his group of 13 freedom seekers.
That didn't work out very well, and that's another story.
Right.
Well, today then, how closely does the barn resemble the barn of 1859? What do you notice?
Well, the barn is still there, but when they converted it to a fire station in 1980, they built a new addition on it. So it's this stone barn that has this modern, the bays where they put the fire station, the fire trucks and fire equipment. And on the exterior, you can still see the stonework. Interior, they did some renovation, but not a lot. And there's the exposed beams. You can see the beams in the ceiling. It's still there. They didn't alter the barn position or anything, and it's in the original position too. So it's you can, if you sort of put your hand up and block out the new part,
right?
You can get a good look at what was there at the time.
I should mention that Judy and Carrie will be presenting They Put Up More Than Hay, Joel and Emily Grover, Their Barn and the Underground Railroad, as part of the 2019 Bleeding Kansas series. Their presentation Sunday, March 3rd from 2 to 4 p.m., so about a month from now, over at Constitutional Hall in Lecompton, Kansas here. The city of Lawrence owns the barn today, Judy. Are there thoughts about converting it to some kind of museum? Is that what I'm hearing? And there are hopes for that?
Well, I used to belong to the Underground Railroad Association of Douglas County. We had a proposal in 2006 to, we'll see if that might be made into a museum or interpretive center. But right now, our new group is called Guardians of Grover Barn, and we still are kind of a new organization, so we haven't really gotten to that point yet where we're talking with the city about what might be done with it.
What are the hopes? What would you like to see happen?
Well, ideally, it would be a public space. As long as the city owns it, it will be a public space, and people can come and see it and come inside and tour the barn and stand in the footsteps of John Brown and these freedom seekers. There were probably more there than those 11 or those 12 that came by. We just don't know about them officially.
I was going to say too, Carrie, that this barn wasn't the only Underground Railroad stop or station in Lawrence at the time.
Oh,
there
no,
were others,
no.
others too, many others.
Many others, but as we said before, this is the only building that we know of where they actually stayed that still exists in one piece. There are other sites, and we know some of the... I mean, there are sites that we don't know about that probably nobody ever will know about.
Right.
And we do know of other sites that were.
I should also want to mention that the presentation that Judy and Carrie will make is the last in a series of presentations as part of the Bleeding Kansas series. You can go online. We'll put a link on our website, kcur.org, later on today, so folks can go on and get more information about this series. I want to thank Judy Sweets, an historical researcher, and Carrie Altenburn for this information about this Underground Railroad stop. It's a great story, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking some time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yesterday on the show, how veterans can turn military skills into civilian jobs. You can find that conversation. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Monday, we talk with council members from Raytown and Overland Park on how they perceive the growing diversity in their cities. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.